Mike says we can convene now, so we're going to convene. Welcome guests and members, I appreciate you coming. Let me just give you a heads up of where we're at here. Members, in your packets, you'll see a copy of this Insurance Federation Minnesota information about auto costs. If you're an interested party in the audience, I think there's extras of these. If you're not interested, then you don't have to have one. Since Bob's not here, we'll just give them out. I think all the members got one, right? So there's some surplus ones there. So just check with Mike, and if you're a lobbyist, they're $10. See, that's not a tax, it's a fee. And so we're going to put that for the food for the committee at a different time. Maybe you're appropriated in the omnibus, so I think we'll be a minute on Thursday. What else we got? There's a couple of little articles for you. The articles are kind of phasing out, but some are always worthwhile. There's only two. This is from Business Magazine, Cost Cutting Gets Creative. Just lying here. I find that's an interesting reading. And then we're going to talk about uncompensated care and how to define it. And it's just interesting how these articles pop up as they're following our lead, I think, is what they're doing now. Anyway, so this is about uncompensated care through a hospital. It talks about terminology and interesting things, and we're trying to address that in one of our parts. Just so you can keep up, if you want to follow through with your copies of the draft, and we're working off, actually it's introduced now, it's
38.
And we're working off the draft. You see the draft. It's draft 053994. Judging the consensus points, I thought I'd just walk you through some things we're not going to be putting in the bill. And we're not going to move amendments today, although I think we'll do some amendments tomorrow. For heads up, we're going to plan to meet again tomorrow and move some amendments. We're going to target 1:30 till 3 o'clock in 500 South. That'll be after session. If you can come, fine. If you can't, we'll be there for a report. And I think we'll meet next week again, and we're getting pretty close to, I think, where we can call us consensus workers. The amendments are coming in, and you'll see some today, and more work to be done yet. I'll outline actually some of that as I walk through now, and then we'll take some testimony. There's a few members drifting around that I'll run by you, but we're not going to act on right now. And maybe, Tom, if you want to just kind of keep track of my deletions so you can create an amendment that will say all that. That'd be nice. Okay, so if you're with me here, as much as I like the page one, article, section one, that seems a little controversial to people, so we're not going to be able to take that too far forward, so that's going to have to disappear. That's the MSHA stuff. The Senate's not going to do it, and a couple members here found it to be not the consensus language, so that's how we have to work this. We're going to take some things out, and I think you'll see at the end we have some things left. On page 7, that discount card, section 6, I still like that idea a lot, and I think what I would do with the amendment will say, on page line 18, we're going to change commerce to health. And then probably some language that appropriates all those monies that go to them from that little card, $25, will go to them to pay for all my studies. Well, at least actually that's what this issue is, but it may cover that. But if you could put that toward the web maintenance, because we're pushing them to work on their website. And I think that they could use the money. I think it'd be just a great place to tie the money into. That's just a thought, so we'll take that for now. For now, on page 8, section 9, which is mine, and then that's the medication therapy management thing. And for now, this may even get smaller, but on line 34, the plan, if you add to the word must, if you insert the word consider and make covering. And if you do that, that just makes it a suggestion, which I like the mention of it. But then when you can ditch a lot of language, on page 9, line 28 and following, subdivision 2 can go away because you don't need to be specific then about all that language. And on top of page 10, you would lose pages 1 through 9. You got that done? Okay. Section 10 of the transfer of regulatory responsibilities, seems like it's sensible. The Senate isn't keen on that, but they're not hating it. So, and the point of that is to be more efficient. And if the dialogue can go forward about how else you might do things to make things more efficient and clean in terms of how they're run on a practical sense, or if they can be persuaded that makes sense, if it saves some money or just makes sense to centralize that, it may actually survive the process. Any questions about Article 1, members? And you can still offer other amendments as you pick up things. I think you'll see some responsiveness and the concerns people have.
Mr. Chair, there's an item on page 4 of Section 4 that has never been very exciting to me. I see it's still in there, the health plan card. I can never quite figure out.
Well, I'll tell you why that is. It doesn't cost any money. This is a purely a provider level. Part of the trouble, what I'm trying to deal with, just to explain it, and if you hate it, we can go down that. But a part of what the concern in some of these things is cost friction. Where at the provider level, they generate a lot of energy. If you kind of be a nice provider, how people know what their coverages are, when a card comes in with the Blue Cross administering the state plan, for instance, you don't know, it says Blue Cross, you don't think it's a Blue Cross plan. And you wouldn't know that it's not a Blue Cross plan, it's a Blue Cross administered plan. And so you wouldn't know what they might cover. You can't make ERISA people do anything, and one idea was to say this is an ERISA plan, then the plan would know, the provider would know that that would be some kind of otherwise not a typical Minnesota product. If you do it this way, then at least the health provider would know that this is some standard Minnesota issued plan. It covers, you know, the mandates, there's a whole bunch of normalities about it that they can expect. If it wouldn't be there, they'd know they have a self-insured product that they would want to try to get a hold of the people. In practicality, the trouble is that a lot of these self-insured plans have a great variety of coverages, especially with the HSAs that come in. You don't know if people have a $2,000 deductible and the first dollar out of their account, or if it's administered to somebody else. And that's the reason for it. So we can talk about it some more, but that's the rationale behind it. It's an absolute no-cost thing. When their cards come out, you just put one more sentence on there. And wouldn't they probably be issuing new cards? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'm not excited yet.
Okay, well.
Just go
ahead. That's fair enough. If I get to the neutral, I'll be happy.
Not there yet.
Okay. Fair enough. Moving along. You'll probably like Article 2. Did you want to say something? Okay. In Article 2, there's been quite a bit of feedback about this, which I appreciate the feedback. Let's go to Section 1 of Article 2, which is on page 10. This whole business about the infection stuff, there's an amendment to be coming from the hospitals, I think, that yet to be imported. So all this business about the infection language, don't give that too much concern just yet. They're going to bring something forward, at least to move the ball about that in a way that they can do that won't be too onerous. And now the Section 2, which is all this other project, we'll be striking on line 33, on page 10, lines 33 to 36 on that page. And then lines 1, 2, and 3 all the way to the period on line 3. And then we're going to strike on line 6 after the period, the rest of that line, and then lines 7, 8, and 9. And then we're going to strike on page 11 still, lines 14 through 21. What you wind up with then, which I think is a positive, and I'll take advice about this, is that the insurance fraud people can talk to the boards when they're engaged in an investigation. It doesn't say when they have to do it, but they would be in their interest to bring the board into it anyway at whatever time they deem to be appropriate. And then the second section, which remains on line page 11, lines 3 to 6, says they can actually talk to them about that they're allowed to disclose that information to the board. And then on lines 10 through 13, it gives the board some more teeth to do what they want to do to these people that are fraudulent. And so in addition to having a license being a criminal, you may find that you'll be disabled from, you'll be disallowed from doing certain billing in certain groups or some other things. So I think it's there seems to be quite a bit of concern about the board being able to mitigate it as an investigation act, and so since that's not going to go, at least the rest of it makes some sense. So I'll take your feedback about that now if you want, or later. So, okay, let's move on. This disclosure language in section 3 on 9/11, page 11, and this is the hospital stuff. There'll be language about that too, I think, from the hospitals. That's hospital disclosure, if you're interested in what that is. That was not provider disclosure. We've not done anything with provider disclosure, and I know there's some bad news working on that before. I don't know what it's working if you need to do more on that topic. I think that would be germane to this project, or some bad news going to investigate how well your idea from last year is working, if it needs to be any more input about that. So that would be appropriate. All right. The next pages, I think, are going to stay pretty much the same at this point. I mean, same at least in terms of taking out massive parts. The section on page 15, section 5, I'll tell you where I think this is going. My goal is to make it the website friendlier to employers, consumers, and professionals who want to look up stuff on there, as well as legislators who want to know what's going on. I don't think that the 20 highest salaries is going to go forward out of this group, at least on the level that I think it needs to go forward. But I think there'd be some way to draft language that the 990s and the information that's already gleaned that's out there for those could be put into a place that's friendly to find. I think that'd be a good step and would be positive and would keep us beneath the bar of excess controversy. So I'll be looking for an amendment that'll describe that.
On that issue, is your intention then to take that language entirely out of here?
I substitute it with something else. So I'll leave it in there just so we know we have to work on it. And so I know it was an area of interest to you. If you would like to work on that, and what I'm hoping for from the plans, and maybe the chamber, if they want to work on this a little bit, is some of the disclosures that are out there are not in friendly places to find. They're out, but they're not accessible. And in some way, to write to direct the department or somebody, the two departments, to somehow clarify that that would be. I'm really liking using the Minnesota info, healthinfo.org. It's already there, it's paid for, and if we can get a little bit of money then with these $25 cards, then that actually would kind of move the ball forward. And the more and more it gets friendly, the more it'll be used, and it'll kind of become maybe a national model, which I think Minnesota should be a model of all kinds of things. So, anyway, if there's a way to get all these disclosures, and when we get to the rest of the disclosures I've asked about the plans to give, a lot of those are already given, and no need to reinvent the wheel. But we do want to make sure that the information is accessible. And so an employer could look on the web and find out what the admin cost of a plan is, how big and how long you've been around, and are they really solvent and worthy of the investing of that trust, and that's that idea. So I think this would be part of that disclosure. That's not a good one.
Mr. Chair, under the current system, it's checking the 990 forms, and sometimes it's only the top two or three people that are put on the 990 forms. And they're very difficult to find. In fact, I did a web search over and over again. You can get into the IRS, you can get into the 990 forms, you can get into the past forms. They're either not updated or they're not complete, or they don't have a number of hospitals in there. So, hospitals, HMOs in there. So I think, we definitely... I did a survey in my district, and 90% of the people thought we needed more price disclosure in health care. I mean, that was the highest number I've gotten on anything I've ever surveyed on in 5 years. So I think that if we don't do something about that, we're not doing something about cost care containment, and the same goes for providers.
Yeah, and I respect that, but not everybody agrees with you.
I'm
trying to move the ball.
People do.
Well, I'm not, fair enough. But just the way we're trying to, and you're free to offer an amendment later and see if you can get people to go with your way. But I'm just trying to surmise what I see to be the consensus points. Just where this bill has to be in order to move, how it's going to have to move in some, orderly fashion forward, trying to bridge the Senate and the House with its differences. I'm just trying to offer my best advice in a friendly way. And Mr. Pendrick, most plans have to provide the top five, right? Isn't that current law for the HMOs? Do you know that?
Mr. Chair, I believe so, yes.
I thought Blue Cross told me that they had to offer 20 or something, that they did provide 20 or something. And Russell Goodman, I think this, because we can't find them, doesn't mean that someone couldn't find them. And so if we tell them to put them in this nice orderly way, then somebody somewhere would do that for us, because we asked them nicely and put it in statute. Anyway, so let's move on. Page 16, one of my favorite sections. Just so you know how I'm working, I'm taking away my good stuff here too. So section 6, I really like that. But I've been persuaded that that's not ready for today. Maybe a different time and a different place. But section 6, which is lines 6 through 25, will be out. Moment of silence, please. Anyway, so, alrighty. Some of these things, when we get a little closer to being done and we are moving that way, I'd like the Department of Health and Commerce and those who are asking to do some jobs to really tell me what I've asked them to do and listing these worthy. What kind of work are we talking about? Is it going to be costly? Is it prohibitive? Is it sensible? Is it already there? In some way, it's pretty good. Can it be tweaked up? Should we put some consumer group to work to find it, you know, bring it more friendly to them? And maybe, just thinking out loud, maybe I'll make a motion. Just a second. Maybe we want to, in some of these, we want to have a few employers feed back to us in the interim time, ask some volunteer employers that could be derived from some groups that would like to talk to employers, either NFIB or the chamber or somebody to try to go on there and see what they wish it would be different like, and have some consumers go on there and see what they wish it would be, and some providers and offer some feedback for the future that would just be almost free advice. So that's kind of a thought. That sounds good.
Mr. Chair, could you summarize what's left of the bill then? I mean, can we know? We know. I didn't catch all the things that you took on. Sorry,
I'm
a little late,
worried.
But I wanted to know if you can kind of summarize. So you haven't made these changes yet, but you're talking about making these changes?
Well, we didn't publish that we're going to do amendments today. And so I'm just telling you, most things are taking out were mine. or things that I've got a lot invested in. And some things, for instance, the EMCHA price premium increase is not favorable to some members on your side of the aisle. And so I surmised that was an issue, and so I figured it's not going to pass in the law anyway. And so there's no point in carrying it around and having us argue about it. And so if you'd like, I can, let me go through once, and then maybe you and I can catch up at the end.
Because, Mr. Chair, if we're going to have an opportunity to do some amendments to this, I think we need to be real clear. Do we have a delete all? We don't have a delete all or anything at this point, right?
No, we don't.
Okay. And but we will have before, like in time before we are able to offer amendments, or how will that work?
I'll have Jason mark up a copy for you so you can see the things that I've taken out.
But Mr. Chair, shouldn't everybody see a copy of that? So if we have an opportunity to draft amendments, we know what we're drafting to?
Well, that's why I'm telling you now what we'll get some delete-alls along the way. It is. For as much paper as I've burned up with the handouts, I'm trying to conserve a little bit of paper just by telling people major sections that are going out. So you'll have, don't worry, you'll know. And the heap of stuff I'm taking out, you're not going to want to amend anyway, so if that helps you. Okay, let's move on. You have a copy of the bill in front of you now?
Yep.
Okay. So on page, just to catch up, so we're up on page 16, section 6, which is lines 6 through 25, would be out. I don't want to miss anything. And so the website stuff, if you can give me some advice about that. And I like the thing about cooperation, health and commerce cooperating. I think that's kind of, why can't we all be friends? But anyway, that's section subdivision 3 on page 17. On page 8, Mr. Pender, perhaps you can give, who's ever working on the cancer drug repository language, there was updated language in the omnibus that there were 3 or 4 amendments to the section that were sent up. So if you can ask Randy or who's ever working on that to update that. That's section 8 on 9:17 and following. There's a few, and there was some question. I don't see Mr. Carlson today, but there was some. Oh, there. Hi. You're hiding behind the chair. There was some language about I define donor to not include manufacturer, and then Mr. Ellison offered me some language to clarify. something about the liability piece, and I'd like to, it's in there, it's probably on the bus, that's the same language, I want to bring that forward. And open advice, yes. Okay, that's, that takes us up quite a ways here. Any questions so far? All dispensing. Okay, it goes on and on. And then page 24, the all this infection business is all going to be changed, I think, reflective of the hospital's input. And the advisory committee and the rulemaking, I told you I'd go anyway, I'm sure that's going to disappear. The page 26, the uncompensated care is going to be replaced by some language that I'm hoping to get from the hospital still, so that's coming. Page 27, section 11, which is lines 1 through 5, is, sorry Joel, it's just not going to make the cut. That's the ambulance liability. That would be out. Sorry, dude. Another bill. It's investing safely in civil law, I think. For another 6 months. And I'd like an opinion from the Department of Health on section 13, page 27, about this grant fund, if there's any merit in that at all. If there's any point in having that language, that would, it says that they could go find some grants, they can find them and pass them out to whoever they want. Probably language you can do anyway, but just give me feedback about that. What did I say? That's section 13, page 27. And I'm still, I'm taking people's advice on page 28 about the health-related boards and the review of judgments. I've asked another board if they'd give me advice about it. They already get that. If they do, it's kind of moot, so I'm not interested in reinventing the wheel. Probably section 17, about your practice standards. Let me just say, I'll be direct about that. The board's not prohibited from doing it now. They could do it if they chose to. I think in the context of no fault, this doesn't make much sense since there's not much else being done in that. I'm just going to leave it in for the moment, but I think that we'll discuss that in the context of the other boards, but I'm listening to people's words about that. And I think that would probably at least be at risk. And this directory, and I'm thinking that the directory would be probably not malpractice. But just a directory, and I'm looking for advice about that. And so that's just as is now, but I think that'll be changed a bit. Any questions about Article 2? I'm telling you these things just so you know where we've done the work on stuff today.
Mr. Chair, on page 24, what did you say we were doing there?
24.
Sorry. You went through a little bit faster.
That's fine. Oh, all that infection stuff?
Yeah.
The hospitals are leaning forward. This is far more than we were prepared to do. It was always a placeholder, and I kind of got people talking, which was sort of the point. There's language coming forward. I haven't seen it yet, but we'll talk about how they're going to begin to define some data, set up some working groups in their own systems, I think. Since this is not meant to be gotcha at any time. It's meant just to provide fair disclosure and... And the adverse reporting system has all been to be positive and not creating harm, but to encourage people to report things, not to not report things. And so I presumably built on that kind of idea. So, okay. Any more questions on Article 2? Okay. It seems that people like this State Improvement Health and Action Plan. This study, let's see, on section 2, page 30, I've got an amendment that was passed out to you, I think. And I'm not offering it, but I'm just bringing it forward right now, and we'll offer it later. It's amendment A3 amendment. Do you have it in front of you?
Yep.
This came from the Insurance Federation. Even with an oral amendment to it. On line 8, after the word utilization, let's see. I want to put the word administrative or administrative costs in there somewhere. Can you tell me where it would fit best? Maybe if you go after provided on line 9. And it says, and administrative costs. It seems like this is a pretty good study to do, and there's a lot of movement toward this, especially given all the action. And the staff makes some technical advice about that, maybe to, to and on line 9 to go away in a comma or something. But we'll. But it seems like the net effect of all the provisions we had about no fault was that it would be at least some more good looking at it, and I think it it begs a lot of good looking, and I think that at least we'll have the same facts to discuss when we come back, and then the dialogue can be based upon that. So, any questions about that?
That's, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Ripsahami.
Just on your amendment, I assume you mean the administrative costs of the of the health plan.
Yes.
Yeah.
You have a better place to
put that in there. Oh, right. That could be construed to mean the administrative costs of the providers.
Oh, yeah, okay. So that'll be so after costs, then of the. Are they considered health plans or the carriers? Oh, yeah. What is this, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, I think. I think auto insurers would be fine.
Oh,
administrative costs of auto insurers.
Okay, very good. And so, are these available to the public or not? Do we make are these copies? Okay, just like to have good public input there. So, give me advice about that. We'll be I'll be offering that in lieu of what was in section 2. And and if I can hear back from the Department of Health, since we're giving their all these jobs, about what their view on Section 3 is, which has to do with this value-added, the value-based business and cost. And there's a whole set of studies that I've asked about in the next section, and I'd like feedback from Congress and Health about what I've really asked for and what seems duplicative. I need to be realistic, I know. I think that goes all the way to the page 34. Line 18 on page 34 is a medical malpractice insurance report. That was the Emmer language, just imported directly from our health committee. Seems like in the same vein as the auto insurance thing, it just seems like it was pretty popular with the health committee. And if we're not going to do any MedNow work, at least this would make some sense. So that's what that is, and I hope that could go forward if it's not too objectionable to anybody. So. And then in particular, I'm very interested in the Commerce's view on this reinsurance, and there's some language I think we need to tweak that up a little bit. I don't know if that amendment handy or not, but that's just an email from the Commerce about that. There's a synthetical language on that. We can bring that up later. And then we're almost done, actually. And then this other Article 4, there's an amendment to that, which was brought forward. Oh, that's not published, right? I didn't make copies of that one yet. There's an amendment to an Article 4. We talked about that. That's where the claims, the six-month thing, if somebody's had a clinic blew up or something, they had a reason to wait more than 6 months. There's a second criteria, too. That's on page 41. And that was, I think, brought forward already, and I got a copy of that one. But there's also a part we need to clarify that it says if for some reason the provider didn't bill because the claim had been denied, and then the insurer reaccepts the claim, that those claims that have not been billed should be allowed to go forward too, and I need some language about that. So except that I think that, and I haven't talked to Mr. Wilkin yet, if he knows I haven't put this bill in here, but I thought since this came from the department that they would be a good place to stick it just to help it get some life. And so if anybody objects to this being in here, let me know that. But besides that, it's meant to be friendly. So the other amendments, there's another amendment you have too, which I'll bring forward today. The A2 one already, didn't we? That's the A2 amendment. What was the A1 amendment? No, the A2 amendment. Since we took the MCHIP thing out, which I'm disappointed about, but I have to understand the realities. enter the public, and it really hampers the people who are not self-insured. And this is a suggestion of study language. I bring it forward now so there's plenty of time for people to look it over and give us their thoughts. Who should pay for MCHA would be that question. And you want to raise your hand? Anyway, anyway, so it's one idea. If you can find a better way, I'm open to that. And if, I think that this is not a study, this says do it, right? Well, it could be a study. Anyway, so this is meant to be study language. I just had to get drafted just for... and so I'm not suggesting that we should do this, but I think that I think we do want to find a way to deal with the MCHA issues in those populations, just from them.
You asked if you had a better idea. Well, I think that Robson Huffley and I and others are authors on a bill that is prepared to take care of that.
Oh, the tobacco thing.
Yes.
Okay. And this would also be a tax swap, too, I guess, if it's 2% for this payroll tax. And if there's some study language that would be beneficial, and maybe it could be tied into even the study about the reinsurance product, because I think that if we can get a decent reinsurance product, that maybe that could be part of where it's carried, and we deal with that population group, if indeed part of it's community rated and part of the deal goes away. And maybe there's enough money to be made, we could even begin to pay for it ourselves just out of savings. I'm not offering this amendment today, it's not drafted just how I'd like, but it's certainly good to create some stir in the groups here, so that's part of why we have you come, so you have a reason to keep coming, and you can go to your principals how you've been watching the store. Anyway, any comments on the... you want to put your bill in this bill, Senator Bradley?
Mr. Chair, members of the Commerce Committee decided that the issue is good for the state.
Okay. Very well. Fair enough, and point well made. Also, just a few amendments that will be coming forward in the translator rank study language, which I didn't mention, but it's still in there. We need to include the deaf persons as well, and there's a technical amendment about that to come. That's the other one. That's the A1. The A1 amendment is going to be about that 12-month deal. All right, any questions from members? And there's one other thing I was thinking about importing to this. I noticed in the omnibus bill, there's a Sinstad bill, which I haven't talked about. There's some, and maybe that's language you should, the department wants to bring into this about some of this technology, the House File 1162, where they talk about, there's language already referenced in there about setting up, you know, tell us what kind we should have, you know, what interoperable language, and this may cover part of that too. So I'm trying to find existing language that makes sense. So that may be an amendment, that may not be. Members' comments. Now we'll go to testimony. Nobody's clearing their throats? No one's clearing their throats. Any comments?
Oh, Mr.
Okay.
Chair?
Yes, that's very much.
I'd just like to say, as far as on the, you know, the attempt here to do something, you know, whether it's a study for MCHA, I think it really merits, you know, consideration in trying to figure out a better way of doing it than we're doing today. Yeah. It's definitely not working out. As far as on the bill itself, if we have suggestions on the wording now, then should we wait for...
If there's the small wording changes, don't bring them now.
Okay.
And we can talk about it.
Wait for the amendment.
Yeah, and, well, and if we can... And I'm not fussy about it. If it's a small technical wording change, I'm not going to make even that goes up necessarily, although it's always written as better, just so it makes it easier for the staff. In terms of substantive things, if there's things you're still concerned about as members that I have not addressed in my deletions and thoughts, then I'd like to hear those either at the table or otherwise, whichever you want. That's going to be the call.
Chairman, in the appendix, I haven't actually looked at these appeals. Anything there that...
That's all part of the Wilson bill. With that passed out of health already.
Okay. This is all his bill?
It's just totally important. Yeah.
Okay.
And if you want to talk about those, you can. It's in this bill, too, so those don't have to go forward.
Thank you.
And just so my members are meeting, hopefully at 1:30 tomorrow, and these amendments will be offered officially tomorrow, we can discuss them. And if you have technical amendments you want to offer, or substantive amendments, then we can vote on those.
So, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, we're going to meet in tomorrow?
Oh, tomorrow at 1:30.
Okay.
In the room 500 South till 3 o'clock. The session goes late, like at least an hour, and if it goes late, we'll still try to meet. And I know we went into the Health Committee's meeting tomorrow after session. Is there a time set for the meeting tomorrow?
Well, after session? Sure, we'll be a little later, probably 4:30.
Okay, it's a little slack time there. I'm not going to step on the health meeting time, and whenever they start, we're going to be done by then. I know the Ways and Means wants to meet, and they'll be talking pretty long before we get there without our help. So, but we'll certainly won't go past the health announcement. That's what that
is. Sure, just to make sure, and I think it goes partly with the Representative Goodwin's question previously. If I understand, then tomorrow the amendments would be to what we have in hand, or I guess equally then to that House file that the bill has been released. So if people do have amendments, discussion, it would be that. Because you mentioned a lot of things. It wasn't clear whether you're going to do a bunch of actions, create a new version.
Well, I'll take advice if you think, because we do have a bill now, so it was easy to change the draft, but now we have a bill. And I could have a delete-all if you preferred. Is that where you had to make a delete-all with those things I suggested?
We could do that, Mr. Chair.
By tomorrow?
Yes. And then the amendments would have to be...
Then we change it all drafting.
That's
what's off this draft. And if there's some difference, sake, I'll go through her and make sure that she knows what I took out in the first few minutes.
So we're going to left the bill.
Right.
Okay.
Now, were you not here either? Let me...
I kind of got up to speed.
Let me just walk through real quick, because I don't want to have people wonder. It's only 15 pages of stuff. I went through the explanation. Article 1, pages, section 1 is gone.
But you're going to offer these amendments then?
Yes, there'll be a
draft.
And that way it's done by a popular method. There's a little bill in front of us that was actually referred to here, and thank you for that. So that's out. On page 7, line 18 is going to be the Commissioner of Health. We'll deal with the cards. And then in order to get language to make the money go to the web.
Right.
Seems like that's kind of a good thing to do, instead of just putting it into somebody's department. On page 8, line's up again. Anyway, line 34, page 8, we're going to say that they must consider covering medication management. That's the plans, they're not making a mandate. And then because it's just a consideration on page line 9, page 9, line 28, all that section goes on the balance of that page through page 10, lines 1 through 9. And so now we're keeping the transfer there just to see if we can get any legs out of that. We're going to be persuaded, hopefully, or the Senate will be that there's some merit in that. On the investigations part on page 10, we're going to strike lines 33 to 36. All the way through lines 1 to 3 on the next page through the period. We're going to strike...
1 to 3 through the period.
Yeah, page 3. Line 3 through the period. And we're keeping notwithstanding. And then on line 6, after the period, we're striking the balance of the paragraph, line 6 through 9. And then in lines 14 through 21 also disappear. So what you have then is that the insurance... the Congress can talk to the boards. They shall at some point, which is only reasonable. If they're going to go to pay that jail, there's something going to tell them later at the end. But they can pick the timing. The board, they can exchange information. They might say, what else we got in this guy? And the board could give it to them. And at the end, the board can make their life really miserable. So I'm thinking fraud is a bad thing. And so I think that's all we did. And then, maybe we're either for the disclosure of executive compensation on page 15. We're going to reference the currently disclosed information and have that put in an easier place to find. So at least the top 5, in some cases more. And then on page 16, and don't know when you got here, page 16, section 6, lines 6 through 25 also disappears. One of my favorite ones.
Yeah.
And then when you get on page 17, the cancer repository becomes clear language. This is an omnibus now, just a few technical, well not technical, but a few.
Okay.
Did
and
answer?
I was here.
Okay, so I hope you got all that. I don't want people to be not on the page. Okay. Questions from members? I think we're moving along.
Is there a deadline for amendments?
Yeah.
Not that I have any particular mind.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. How much time do we just need time to copy them, right?
Yeah.
This is a, you know, some things are just, some people have left, but if amendments are really controversial, and I think we'll just discuss them a little bit, and if they're, if you have enough copies to go around and they're simple and just technical wording things, you know what I'm looking for in some of these.
Okay.
Okay, with that in mind, I do want to take testimony, and how many people have done this? Okay, we have three people, four people have signed up to testify. How many, who besides on the list wants to testify today? Five people. We should go with ways and let's see something. Oh, there's an insurance. There's an insurance thing at the teacher's plan is up a sixth in policy. We want to go with that, I think. So we're going to try to get done by that. So if testifiers can come and maybe do 5 minutes, if they want to do more later, we can do that tomorrow or in private. Is that? If you just can't stand 5 minutes, then tell me that. But Ms. Hartner, why don't you come up and give us your 5 minute walk to fame here.
Mr. Chair, it'll be less than that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartman. I'm a committee for the commission serving deaf and hard of hearing people. And thank you for giving me time to speak in support of the amendment that would add sign language interpreters to the portion of the bill that addresses the availability of interpreters and addresses the question of who pays insurance companies or providers for the cost of interpreters. I usually don't testify, members of the deaf community do, but because no interpreters are available because of the shortage of interpreters, I'm here speaking today. And I'll convey the concerns of the commission members of this, members of the deaf or hearing or deafblind community. The bill is needed because the shortage of qualified sign language interpreters in the state and the responsibility for the cost of payment of interpreting services creates barriers that prevent deaf, hard of hearing, and deafblind people who use sign language from getting the health care services they need. Our office gets phone calls on a regular basis, and we really haven't been able to get our arms around this problem, and this study would really help to address that. Over the last few years, Minnesota has had an increased demand for sign language interpreters. A new video relay service that provides access to the phone has hired many of the best in the neighborhood, and that's reduced the number of people that are available in the community. Some of this technology might be able to address some of those needs in the study to help look at those ways of filling those shortages. Some of the deaf and hard of hearing and deafblind people that we work with are new Americans and come from many different countries and use spoken language interpreters at the same time that they use sign language interpreters. We work with people that have immigrated from Somalia, from the Hmong community, Vietnamese community, Latino community, and sign language interpreters work hand in hand with spoken language interpreters in these situations. And while healthcare providers are obligated to provide interpreters through state and federal law, the responsibility for payment has not been clearly defined. And because of that, it's resulted in lawsuits that actually there was one legal peer review that just occurred this year. It was about $300,000 settlement. So those can result in, you know, unnecessary expenditures if some of this is cleared up. The study would look at barriers and look at ways of overcoming them, and we look forward to working with providers and insurers, limited English-speaking communities, the deaf and hard of hearing communities that work on overcoming that. So we appreciate you adding sign language interpreters to that question.
Thank you. Question from members? Thank you. Mr. Schwartz, is it? John Schwartz?
Yes.
Are you John Schwartz? Hold on.
I'm John Schwartz.
Yeah, I was talking to one of the people in the back of the room. They were kind of talking to.
My name is John Schwartz. I'm an MSHA policyholder, and I'm here today representing AMP, the Association of MSHA Policyholders. Now, I was here to talk about the change in the rate range from 115 to 135. My understanding is in one way.
Okay. Well, let's just spend a few minutes talking about this MSHA in general.
Well, I would like to talk about the payroll tax. And I can sit here and tell you about MSHA all day and ERISA.
So you're liking my amendment then?
I'm not liking that amendment.
Oh, you don't like the payroll one either?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
Neither do I, but I just thought it
out. Okay. I testified about a week and a half ago Representative Bradley had a bill, I believe it was HF 1168, which was going to change the funding from the assessment on insurance companies based on premium income to tobacco tax funding. On the payroll tax, what our big issue is with changing the funding approach from basing it on the insurance companies and putting it somehow into general fund dollars. We feel that that puts the funding of MSHA into an unstable footing, dependent upon the gaining of general fund and funding of all the various programs. As of now, what exists with MSHA is a solution to an insurance market problem of not being able to insure high-risk people. The solution to that problem right now with MSHA keeps the problem and the correction for it within the market of health insurers and policyholders. The market problem is, in our eyes, caused by the insurance companies because they will not insure us. So we believe that the costs of MSHA should be borne by both our policyholders and the insurance companies, the two players in that market. Okay? And we feel that it gets put into more of a general fund financing, but that puts it on unstable financing grounds. And at that point, then we'd be subject to politicking with all the other businesses. And we point to what has happened in Medicare as an example. Medicare has been greatly cut, and there have been shifts in the funds raised to fund MSHA from that healthcare fund to be used for other purposes. So we worry that MSHA would cut back, the coverage would be cut back, premiums may increase exponentially. We just feel like MSHA then would be on unstable ground. Yeah. There are alternatives for using the insurance assessment method used right now, and payroll tax is one of them. There are other methods, though, that other states use. One is that they put the assessment on the new insurance rather than the commercial insurance of people like Health Partners, because the new insurance umbrella captures almost all people covered by health insurance in the state. All people registered and licensed to offer health insurance in the state must buy into the insurance plan. They must do it. Dealing with the self-funded plans, almost all self-insured plans purchase with insurance coverage. So then you've got a bigger universe of people. And what we feel is turning it into using more of a general government funding is bigger government. Right now, MSHA exists as a nonprofit private entity with certain funding mechanism as is. Turning it into general fund revenue financing makes it more of a state program and bigger government as opposed to a smaller government role right now. I can wrap up here really quick. So what we think needs to be done before there is change in the funding basis for MSHA, whether it be tobacco tax, payroll tax, etc., is that more study is needed on this, and that the way other states go about this in different ways should be looked at. We don't think this should be rushed into. So I think the bigger picture, and even changing the 115 to 135 rate, I just want to mention, that's not a cost containment proposal. right, you have it, like a chalkboard here, a jaw, two big circles, one on label revenue, and the other on label expenditures. I assume that the revenue thing in the paper, the investment comes just from those premium payments. I've seen no study that says that's exactly where the money comes from. Health Partners has a bunch of revenue. There's nothing to say that the assessment cost isn't spread amongst all of its business or more of its business than just premiums paid by the policy holders.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your provocative testimony.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thanks for
okay.
Mr. Birch. How's time? You want to talk? You want to get on the list? Did you want to come or not? Not related to the last testimony.
No, Mr. Chairman, actually, I wasn't able to be here yesterday, but I understand there were testifiers from the Council Health Plans who went over the majority of my comments. So, in the interest of
like everything I'm doing, they said do more of it and we could have a little more guidance.
I'll have to go back at the table and verify that.
That's what I heard him say.
But I'll let their comments in.
And actually, as you go on, I think I've heard a lot of concerns from the group and make sure I'm on the right track with them. So thank you for coming forward. That's how short testimony can be. Mr. Gross.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack Gross. I'm with the Department of Commerce.
Go ahead.
Well, I got to ask you some questions.
Oh, okay.
You're in.
I'll yield.
Okay. I can't remember when those were created, but probably in the Representative Greenfield will probably can enlighten me if they ever created as part of Minnesota Care. They were designed to allow the consumers, the people out there, to create their pools and not have interference from the health plan. So you create this pool and ultimately you go to the health plan and say, insure me. And I think that's crucial to understand that the purchasing pool is insured by a health plan. Thus, the health plan is assuming the risk. And so what you have in your bill here is that after 5 years, the purchasing pool can obtain those reserves. And I question that because, again, the health plan is the one that created that we need to have to have the reserves to be remain solvent and pay claims.
Yeah, let me explain it. Actually, there's a technical thing about that bill. What I meant to take, part of it's a driving to address that part, too.
Mr. Chairman, before you go, yeah. Where are we at in the bill here?
This is Article 1, Section 5.
Yeah, there's a Knobloch bill, which I was thought I was working off that idea, and the language that got imported was actually a whole bunch more language about, as I understand, there's part of it that I wrote, and I was trying to work off the co-op model, the service co-op model, trying to create more of a market. And it's like we can dialogue about this and maybe even more offline too, but it's appropriate now because this is a kind of a valuable part of the bill if it's not just totally stupid. But it's, as I understand, when an entity joins a service co-op, they accumulate reserves either by putting some in or they build some up. And when they leave, they have to leave them behind. And it seems that's actually an unfair advantage to the co-op. Because once they've built up reserves, it's kind of like, they joined the club. And so the service co-op, if you have a lot of reserves, has a lot less reason to be service-oriented because they've got the money tied up and they're not likely to move. And so the five-year thing was a method, and I'm open to tweaking it to from never to 10 years or whatever number makes sense. But it seems like there should be a way to get your stuff out over time, and so I thought if you took out 20% a year, then you would have left in a kind of a, they've had the use of the money, and then they would kind of become more service line and bring more people in who would then. And then I tried to also, if you came in with a lot of bad history for any numbers of reasons, which that's the part I don't know about how that would work exactly, but if you there's lots of reasons people have bad history. One is that they don't know how to manage their group, and the second is they just have a lot of poor results, a lot of people have a lot of bad health outcomes just as a suddenly I don't know how to properly weight that. So if the co-op would take on not undue amount of risk in their reserves, so you'd have to find a way to weight those reserves and bring them to back your experience. That's the idea of it. And, I was told by staff the target language was extraneous that got imported. So if you can, that's the intent. And thinking that, and then this reinsurance business ties into that whole thing, so it's all part of a, if small employers or co-ops or even the large plans had access to reliable, cost-effective reinsurance, then more could do NIWAs, and that would create more market, because then people could gather up 10,000 lives and go do their own thing and actually find a way to tie it to our HSA somehow or tie it into any number of products they could buy for the 0-50,000 part, etc. So does that help? Or does that make it worse?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to yes, it helps a little bit.
Okay. So tell me where I'm right or wrong, will you?
Well, I think it probably needs some input from the health plans, too, about the fact that those reserves are there to keep the health plan solvent. I think they do need them. Even when somebody comes and goes, those reserves should remain with the health plan. I think we can further discuss
it. You understand my point, though, in trying to find a way, because if because once you're in, you have no reason, because they could quit being nice to you because you have this $1 million or more or whatever that's tied up in that. That's my thinking of it. So, go on, you're doing great.
Sure.
Mr. Hunt, that's going to help me.
Well, all the purchasing rules will fail unless there's a penalty for getting out of them. Because what will happen is somebody will come along and sell insurance to some company that's in the pool if they happen to be healthy. And every one of these nationally where this has happened, all the healthy companies get sold out because they get a cheaper rate outside than they can in the pool, and they leave behind all the sick people.
Yeah.
All the companies that have sick employees.
And they have a penalty of half.
What happens to their rates?
If it was a penalty of half, would that help?
Well, it's funny debate how much of a penalty they need to keep them in the pool.
Yeah, so you want them to be stable, yet you want the service to be there, so. Anyway, I appreciate that. Go ahead, Mr. Gross.
Mr. Chairman, on page 7, section 6, the cash payment discount card, I, again, need some clarification here. Do we create a network of providers? Because giving somebody a card that says they're going to get up to a 25% discount, right, they would probably like to know where they can achieve that.
And I don't, and tell me from the provider point of view. People show up every day at my office with all kinds of little deals. That I'm in a number of I'm in all kinds of plans, and I think that at some point you might even list them on the web. I suppose they might go on the website. They'll be credit. These are not sanctioned providers. They're just licensed providers, and they've not been scrutinized except that they're willing to accept the discount. It's especially for people that have cash, that have no insurance, and it would get them away to. I get a discount, not even as big a discount as they get under Blue Cross or Medicare or whatever, because I think they give deeper discounts than that. But it's a way to cut it, to give a person at least 25% coverage. And maybe that's the wrong number, maybe 30% is better. But I would think that you would not, I don't want to, there's no point in incurring network costs. It's and I think that they would call up their chiropractor or their family clinic and say, do you take the card? And they'd say no. And they'd say thank you. And then they'd call up somebody else, and people would or they wouldn't. And I think the discounts are deep enough that the plans give that most providers would take this. And you could even set the discount that they would like. They could. It's up. That's why I even made it up to. So no provider would feel a burden to take. If they took, if people would be happy with a 5% discount, then that would, they'd be a 5% clinic. And I think it might evolve. That was the simplest. It's meant to be simple. And whatever agency does it. We just send out a card, and if they renew it, if they lost it, maybe charge $10 for a new card or something, just to cover the costs and maybe generate a few dollars. I think a few people might take advantage of this. If 10,000 took advantage of it, you'd raise 250,000. If 100,000 bought it, you'd raise $2.5 million. And because I think it would be valuable to people. That's my thought, and it seems harmless. And if there's any harm in it, I'd like to know that too.
Well. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the harm we could maybe see here, we see this on the internet where some entities advertising that they can get these discounts with off their insurance. So what it is, again, it's a similar to what you're proposing, a discount. It's a preferred provider organization. You can go to this provider and you get the discount. What we see happen occasionally, and we put out a cease and desist order into energy because they weren't properly disclosing the fact that this is not insurance. And so the person assumes this is insurance, they drop their insurance, they go, and now they've got this $20,000 discounted surgical bill to pay for. And that's where the caution, I think, has.
Well, that's reasonable, yeah.
We just want to make sure, if this goes forth, that the consumers totally understand this is not insurance. This is a form of getting a discount.
Maybe Mr. Carl Santos can practice some language to put disclosures. It'd be a pretty big card with his language on there, but it'd be a six-page, yeah, it'd be a six-page card. Those are fair. Welcome to the committee. Anyway, so I appreciate that. So except for that, otherwise there's some, you think that people might take advantage of it? I mean, in a positive way, you think this would be beneficial to?
I think it could. I think we have to look at too what it would cost for the Commerce Department to issue, you know, these cards. What kind of mechanism we'd have to set up there is,
yeah,
to issue these cards too.
Fair enough.
Last one,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. That sounds good.
Do you have a view on who would benefit from these cards in terms of, I guess one of the concerns that I've said along the way is that in many communities there's only one option. There isn't other providers out there, and so that provider could just say, no, I'm not going to use the card, so it creates a disparity within the system as to who actually can use them and who can't. Do you have a view on whether this would disadvantage some rural areas or advantage certain areas of the state more than others or anything along those lines?
Mr. Chairman, I think there's always that possibility. A couple weeks ago I talked to various Minnesota Medical Association, various organizations, and asking what they thought, and some said, you know, they know for sure some providers would certainly provide the discounts, where others certainly will not. So that's the problem you could have, and conceivably you could have, and we'll always pick on Black Duck, but you could have in some community that the provider just does not want to accept any more discounts. That's a possibility.
Well, thank you.
The last thing I like, two more things. One is quickly, dealing with our fraud unit. That's a police, we have a police power.
Did you hear the amendment that I did? Pardon? Did you hear the amendment that I did?
Yes. But I think the wording is that we have some problems with the shall consult.
Right.
Because we have this police power. We have the right to go out there and subpoena and arrest and et cetera, et cetera. And we feel that maybe after we get our investigation completed, and everything tidied up, arrest the individual, then we can inform the board.
So if we're informed better, is that better?
Mr. Chairman, pardon?
Is inform a better word instead of consult?
They're
a good one to me, but would that be better? The word inform, shall inform?
That might be an alternative.
Yeah, it's like the dialogue. Yes. To make it work. I tried to listen to your concerns before. So.
Then,
keep going, I'm interrupting.
Then last but not least, again, some of these studies, et cetera, we'll probably maybe have to have this one up. But one thing I'd like to, I'm not going to do it now because we're running out of time, but I'd like to maybe discuss with somebody here. And I wasn't available for the testimony on the reinsurance stop loss issue. I just try to get a better feel as to what where the issue is there and try to understand that a little more thoroughly.
All right, let me, I want to respect Ms. Braystow coming in, so let me just take 3 minutes on that. Is that your, have I exhausted your list of things you wanted to say? Let me just take 3 minutes on that, and then we'll discuss this some more. It's my perception that we still lack a market, and part of the market has to do with the ability of anybody who wants to make a MIWA or to pool and so on, and for people to have a bona fide option. And it seems like the linchpin, as the people, as talking to Bob Johnson, my credential left, and the people, the hard part is to find the pot of money that can be the reinsurance pot of money. Who can control your reinsurance options, controls who gets to be a player. It seems like that's my view anyway, is that that's the expensive risk. Not in terms of the bulk of the premium, but somebody has to do that for somebody. And if you have a good pot of money, you can become an insurance company. You can then get the advantage of doing the business with that. If you don't, and that's where your disadvantage. That's where the service co-ops seem to buy reinsurance. But anyway, so there's if there's a way to create easily accessible reinsurance based upon Minnesota risk, not on risks that are elsewhere, it seems like there'd be somewhere to go that would be favorable to both, to all the parties involved, except for the sellers of reinsurance who aren't from Minnesota. This comes up especially in the malpractice world, but also it's my opinion that that's something that's an issue here. You're talking about MCHA and all these other things that, you know, community rating or not, and that whole argument about it. It seems like there was a stable reinsurance, more than if there was a cheap as you could make it reinsurance product available. It would give us a base to build all kinds of creative options to do what the service co-ops are doing, to do what the Blues are doing, and, you know, health partners, et cetera, what they're doing, available to anybody who wanted to buy into it. That's a Minnesota player. And at least that way you remove that variable and that cost. Because it'd be as cheap as it could be based upon what we were really doing here. And beyond that, I don't even know how you'd study it, but there was a reinsurance pool that's gone defunct and that's referenced in the bill. But that was not, that was run by people who had, they were run by insurance companies, I think, if I'm correct about that. With no disrespect meant. They may have had a vested interest in it not going forward as well, but if they did or didn't, that's beyond this discussion. But if the governor would appoint, or somebody would appoint people whose job it was to either as a, give them a per diem because they're retired people who know the business, or people who became making their business, that their job would be to create as good a reinsurance product as could be gotten through however you do that. The state would back it with its own credibility or through using WICRA as a temporary pot of money to give short-term cash flow and backing. At the same time, partitioning WICRA so that they would not be not at risk of losing any money, because you don't want to put them at risk. That's a whole separate reinsurance pool. And then you build all your different, you could use that as a base to build all kinds of alternate plans. That's the idea, anyway. So does that help?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Am I talking nonsense, or does this make sense? Okay. And so that's what my desire was, that you would look into that and see if it makes sense or not. That's the desire. If that's easier, I don't know if it's controversial. I don't know that. If it's controversial to plans who operate out of Wisconsin or the Bahamas and come here, I don't care. If it's controversial to Minnesota companies that want to do business, maybe they'll be pressed to keep their rates low and help people develop options. And either way, I'm happy. So I'm trying to get the cost out of it to help people get better coverage. So, is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any questions about that? I've discussed this a number of times, and I'm looking to become smarter about this. Okay. Thank you. And anyway, actually, you're one more. Ms. Jones, you have 2 minutes, I guess, right? Did you run out of time? And then Twyla, you get your whole 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to talk about two divisions.
Okay, real fast thing?
Well, three maybe.
Never mind that.
First is the provider disclosure. I think you've done a lot in this bill to try and help consumers be better buyers of health care, and you've done a lot in terms of the quality side. And we also think that really to get best value, which is what all of us want out of the healthcare system, we need to know both sides of the equation, and so to have the value and the disclosure. And I'd like to work, I think we can strengthen that section. I know that Sam Goodwin's been interested in this as well, but I think we might have some suggestions to help strengthen that language, and I'd like to work with you on that. And second is
That's a good idea. And Lipson and Bradley had some language before, so you'd work off that previous one.
And then the second area deals with the study, I think, that was brought up earlier, dealing with the language interpreter services. Language interpreter services are federally mandated and are required to be provided by the provider. And basically what this study is looking for and what the previous legislation was is to figure out a way to shift those costs to someone not the provider. But I think federal law is pretty clear in the fact that these services should be provided by the provider, and they should be paid for by the provider, or expected to be paid for by the provider. I know there's lots of concerns with how these services are being provided, and there's, you know, there's probably something to study here, but we have concerns about the shifting of a federal mandate and presumably coming to the state legislature and deciding who will pay for a federal mandate. Businesses are mandated all, you know, lots of different things come on businesses from the federal government, which none of us like to pay, but we're not here at the legislature asking someone else to pay those federal mandates. And I think so that at least that component of this study, like I said, I think there are some serious issues with interpretive services and more and additional study, but I would hope maybe we would take out the study of the financial aspect of that.
You mean not have a study at all?
No, I think the Section 1 looks at ways to achieve the needed availability and some other things.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Jones? Seeing none, thanks. That actually was another good example of good testimony. So you get to the point. Ms. Brace, we have 5 minutes for you, 1 minute to say goodbye, and we'll be done by six. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that this bill is, your goal is cost containment. Clearly, that's what the committee is about. But I look at what the bill is offering, and I don't necessarily think it's going to take you where you want to go. And then furthermore, I think it's going to bring the government into people's lives in ways that are going to intrude on their privacy and lift their autonomy and essentially build the public sector. So the three things I want to bring to your attention are some of the reasons why there are how we could do it better, but what's not in the bill, and then a few things that we like that are in the bill, and then some of our specific concerns. So let me just say that in order to achieve cost containment, you really need the individual who cares about all these things that you care about in the bill, who cares about what the administrative costs are, who cares about what the total cost is, what the bill is, etc. And that means that they have to have cash in their hand. And that there's a little piece of it happening with the card, but not much else. And as you probably know, the cost of health care, medical services, isn't rising to the same degree that the cost of insurance is rising. And so, as a practitioner, you probably understand that you are not seeing the double-digit increases. And so, clearly, the increases are not happening really at the provider level, but they're happening at the insurance level. And then, if patients really had more options, we'd probably see more competition, and there'd be less need to all the accountability pieces that you're looking at in the bill. And essentially, you're right, there's no longer a market. A monopsony, or monopoly, like people like to think of it, is it would be better to break it up rather than to try and monitor and control it, because then we'd actually have competition. So the things that we like in the bill are, in particular, moving the HMO regulation to the Department of Commerce out of the Department of Health. The fact that you acknowledge the value of cash payments and the problem that people have when they come with cash and they don't get the same discount that others do. And then the fact that you just took away the mandated benefit for the medical therapy that was in there, that was going to be a mandated benefit, but you just buy it. You just amended that.
Okay. Are you glad about
that? Uh-huh. Oh. And mandated benefits make healthcare more expensive. And then our specific concerns, having to deal particularly with government intervention, is the fact that you are making last year's best practices law become permanent policy. And as you know, there were hundreds and hundreds of citizens who opposed that via petition campaign. And so now you're making it permanent policy. On page 31, you talk about reporting cost and quality. And our concern, of course, is that that's going to do two things. It's going to decrease access to care, because somebody's going to decide what quality is, and somebody's going to report on that. And then, like in New York, there will be the problem of some physicians actually deselecting patients that didn't make their scores look good enough. And when you have to report cost, that can that can make costs not go as low as they possibly could if you didn't have to report them. And then on page 16, the fact that the health department is going to become this sort of all information service is not something that really we don't really feel the government needs to be in that position. And the statewide action plan, which I know you said on page 29 that a lot of people like, we actually see that as a growth of government. When you're going to build a statewide health improvement plan, it's going to require looking at the people's lives to make sure that you're actually moving towards whatever is determined as improvement. So it's really building the public sector and building government. And then the last piece is we have concerns about what's happening to a person's right to privacy in this bill. On page 37 and 45, it changes the language and allows health plans and others to share data as, I think they say, permitted or authorized by law. I know that's the wrong term, permitted or required by law. And what that does essentially is make our Minnesota law, make health plans, et cetera, all follow HIPAA, the federal rule, rather than the Minnesota law. And the Minnesota law on privacy is the one of the best laws in the country, and it really guts that and takes it out of patient consent and makes it follow the federal rule.
So statute refers to Minnesota law, that's what that means. And then law would be any law.
Exactly. Any law, and that makes it federal law as well. And then on page 24, we don't really like the idea of a new surveillance system. And of course, you said that there's going to be an amendment. So I guess we'll have to see the amendment to see if there is the infection, the reporting of infection.
Oh, yeah.
To see whether or not there's actually individual or identifiable data that's going to end up in the health department. And three more really quick things. Page 4, definition of non-emergency. You're going to require that allow utilization review organizations to telling them that they have to create this definition of non-emergency care, which makes it more difficult for people to actually get health care services and whatever they decide is a non-emergency. So you will be, by law, requiring something, but then actually have no accountability, and they will be allowed to do at their discretion whatever they decide is a non-emergency. At page 7, the cash card. I see your desire, but I have to ask, why does the state need to produce a card? There are lots and lots of people that go and negotiate cash rates. To create a state card is to create a new bureaucracy. And why should the limit be at 25%? I've gotten personally discounts at 50. As soon as you set whatever the limit is, it's actually going to not allow lower. And practitioners are going to say, probably, they're going to move toward, if you don't have a card, you don't get a discount. That makes it really easy. So you essentially strap it, and it's really not a free market. The last is on page 11 and page 26 are just increased reporting requirements. You said that one is coming from the hospital on page 11. We don't know what it is, but any time you have increased reporting, it just increases the cost of healthcare and the bureaucracy and the paperwork. So those are our concerns. Those are the things that we like, and that's our input.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
I gave you 8 minutes. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Brace, thank you very much. You always bring forward some very interesting ideas, and a couple of them jumped out at me. One of the things that you said was the individual must be able to be essentially a purchaser rather than just a consumer, and I think that, or rather than just a patient, really. And I think that's a very interesting and statement that I agree with. There's also, you said something about more options also increases accountability, and I think that moves in the right direction. One of the things I wanted to ask you, though, is that often we make an assumption about competition and lower costs. In a true free market, that's accurate. My question is in regards to healthcare, which is not a true free market. I don't believe we're seeing that. Do you have the data that shows that in states that have greater competition, they have lower costs? For healthcare?
Ms. Grace, why don't you just answer it? So we're past our 6 o'clock time. So we can either come back and do if you want.
Or, Mr. Chair, I can just get the information.
Yeah,
I'm just curious as to the correlation.
Okay.
It's really a good answer.
Okay. I'll just answer that very briefly. The problem all across the country is that we're moving to fewer and fewer and fewer healthcare systems, and we're really taking away healthcare competition.
So, except for talking to Ms. Brace, we're done for today. We'll be back tomorrow at 1:30 in room, whatever it was, 500 South. If you have ideas or thoughts, you're welcome to find me, find the colleagues, draft amendments. We'll be doing this tomorrow, and then probably meeting again next week on this bill. So, it's moving along. Some of the diamond is showing through somewhere, I think. So your audience is free to go if you like. So Ms. Brace, we can take a couple of minutes and we're going to go ourselves.
Thank you.
Well, there's the people that are not hearing going at 6 for the state insurance plan. So I want to respect the audience for that. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So what I will say is that the states where they have had an increase or a growth in individual, independent cash-taking clinics, they have seen those costs for that kind of health care go down and down and down. And so that when you move towards having more traditional insurance, then you see the cost of health care go down, you see the negotiation go up. And I think that we have not fully seen what is possible yet until we move towards more traditional insurance and we actually see what happens when people start to have a real negotiation and a real conversation between themselves and their physician. And so what do I really need?
Kristen, how many did you have?
Yeah, I'm answering this phrase. I'm just trying to understand you are supporting the marketplace and healthcare, I think, and want to see it improve. But then you said that people that pay cash don't get the same discounts as people that have insurance where they've negotiated the discount. Isn't that the marketplace?
Ms. Brooks.
Actually, the problem is that very, very few people have cash now, and a lot of the hospitals aren't used to or don't even tend to think of it, and a lot of people don't know that they could actually negotiate. What we really need to do is to build the system where the hospitals, the providers, actually start to realize that they need to negotiate, and that really happens when you have more cash in hand. Right now, we just have a few people that pay. Oftentimes, they're not thinking about the fact that they have any power to negotiate in the system. But those that do can come up with some very good pricing in comparison to those that don't.
Does that mean we should have fewer people with insurance so that they all have to pay cash?
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, what that means is that we should have more people with traditional insurance so that they don't have to cash for the most part ever into their insurance company until they have something that's really major, and that doesn't happen to most people.
That's another answer.
Well, Mr. Chair, Walmart can sell things cheaper than anybody else because they cut a better deal. And that's where the marketplace leads. The marketplace deals with efficiency and maximizing profit. It does not deal with fairness and equity. In healthcare, you need fairness and equity. And the marketplace will never deliver it.
Good point. Anybody else?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Twilight, Ms. Brace, I just have a question for you. You did talk about, too, how the fact that medical care costs, you know, are rising, obviously, but you said insurance costs are rising much quicker. As far as
I think it's agent commissions.
Yeah, well, that's probably true. But,
well, hopefully it's part of it.
Yeah. But do you have exact figures on the differences? Just out of curiosity.
Ms. Brace. I think that I could get those for you. I do know that when they have looked at the cost of, for instance, physician services, and they have watched them, percent-wise go up very slow, and some of them have decreased, whereas we have certainly have the insurance rates as they have gone up. So I'm sure that could be gotten. I don't have it at my fingertips. I'm not sure it could be gotten.
Okay. I just wanted to point out, members, because, I mean, I would expect that to happen because of additional costs and things that are involved in the insurance world where, you know, they cover so many more things than just the increases in the healthcare costs, too, that happen. And so I just wanted to point that out.
Well, thank you, members. I appreciate your attention. And see you tomorrow at 1:30, and we're adjourned.